Hey, what is going on, everyone? It's me, Mr. Mario, and welcome back to another episode of Mod Chat. For those who do not know, this is a podcast I do here in two different forms. First of all, it is available in a video visual form here on the Mr. Mario 2011 YouTube, Rumble, and Odyssey channels. Also, if you want to take it around and listen to it in an audio-only form like an actual podcast, simply look up Mod Chat, all one word, on your favorite podcasting app, host, provider, or platform. I know it's not available on all of them, but it's available on most of them. Either way, this here is a podcast where I come on, I talk to you all a little bit, at least once a month, about new things that I find interesting, cool, things that I want to share, talk about, even do a little bit of show and tell in the world of video game console modding and video game modding in general. Typically, we have a good time here. I have my dog Lily in the background who, well, I interrupted her from licking her paws, but usually we end up having a fun time. Now, unfortunately, it looks like there's only going to be one episode this month in March 2024, but at least we are getting one out here, and there's going to be a lot that we're going to be talking about, so let's just not delay and let's just go ahead and get right into the topics here. So right off the bat, I'll give you all a heads up. We're going to be covering a lot of original Xbox content here at the beginning. And the first one is here from developer Grimdoomer, who said here on Twitter, "I've been working on a proper HD patch for Halo 2 on the original Xbox, and I'm excited to say I have it rendering at 480p, 720p, and 1080i, which is actually 1080p internally. This patch takes full advantage of overclocked CPU, GPU, and RAM upgrade. There's still more work to be done to fix some pop-in issues, but the patch is almost complete. I plan on posting a full-length video going over all the details and showing comparisons between the different resolutions and frame rate with and without a CPU upgraded console. Fun fact, even though the game says it supports 480p, it's still rendering at 640 by 480 internally and upscaling it to 480p. It does not natively support 480p or widescreen. So that's really cool. Even if you just wanted like a proper 480p mode or patch on here, this might be really awesome to see. Now, I'm playing the video right here he recorded, and this is Halo 2 playing on an original Xbox natively at 720p. Now, it looks really nice, and you can see the frame rate up here in the corner where it's not going to be the most stable type thing, which is understandable. I do know Halo 2 was really pushing the original Xbox to its limits, and then you have this, which is going to push it even further. Now, I'm thinking this is cool, and the first thing I thought of when I saw this was I believe there was a 720p patch for the original Halo that you can play on the original Xbox, and I did play a little bit of it, and I remember when I was talking to someone about it, I was telling them, you know, like, it's playable, but the frame rate is not going to be the best on there, and they told me that, yeah, you know, it's a nice, essentially, like, tech demo, essentially, where it looks nice. It's not the most playable thing, but it is really cool to be able to use it for screenshots. So you can see right here during the in-game cutscenes, it seems to be all right, but I know later on here, for example, you can definitely see during some of the more iconic parts, it's definitely chugging along. So this is no issue of the patch. This, I would say, is to be expected here. And I have no doubt you can get some extra performance with upgraded CPUs and GPUs and RAM, of course. But if you're playing this on a stock Xbox at completely stock timings, you're probably not going to get the best performance, which is, again, going to be expected. But again, this is really cool to see at a technical level. It was also mentioned down here when Harcroft asked, are you patching the base game or one of the updates? Grim had said, base game for now, will probably port to the last title update at a later point in time. So just keep a lookout for that. Prometheus or PrometheOS, which is essentially a replacement firmware or operating system that you can install on Xenium chips, for example, has been updated a few times, and this is not even the most recent update. However, I did want to cover this here because as of version 1.2.0, it did end up including some pretty big things. One of them here being that you can now use it on more chips than just the Xenium chips, but the other thing is that you can now unlock orphan original Xbox hard drives. So at this point, you do not need to have the motherboard they came from, you do not need to have the EEPROM key. Quite literally, if you have an original Xbox hard drive which is locked and you can access it using a console that has Prometheus installed on a mod chip, you can end up unlocking the drive. Let's go ahead and actually watch this right here from Harcroft, where he has this fired up on his console. And let me see here, he has Prometheus loaded up. He's going to go down to system settings, I believe. Here we go. And where's he going to next? It's going to be utilities, hard drive lock and unlock. So here is one. This is a Western Digital 8 GB drive, which has been locked. So you can just tap the A button here. It's going to unlock it. Unlocking VSC, and check this out. Copy these and keep safe. You have the master password as well as the user password, which is really awesome to see here. So again, now if you have an orphaned hard drive, as it says, you can unlock them. And this is not only really impressive, but also really important, because with the original Xbox, unfortunately the hard drives, since they're so old, are dying on there. And when it dies, the system does not work. But even if your hard drive is working, what if your system ends up dying, or somehow your hard drive is separated from your motherboard? Well, before you really didn't have a way of unlocking that drive, but in the last few years, there's been a lot more advancements to be able to unlock these drives, essentially using known master passwords and even drive vendor commands to get them unlocked. So this is really awesome to see, an advancement that I love checking out for the original Xbox. Speaking of advancements for the original Xbox, it's been asked so many times, and friends of the channel, the Insignia team, have been working hard at making it happen. But as of the release of this episode here, Halo 2 on the original Xbox is now live once again for the first time in well over 10 years. This is not using a LAN service. This is not using LAN tunneling. This is true Halo 2 matchmaking on Insignia, which is the free replacement original Xbox Live 1.0 service. So this is big, because if you are registered on Insignia, all you need to do is bring your own copy of Halo 2, get connected online, and you can play tried and true matchmaking on the public beta of Insignia, which is open to everyone. So due to this happening, there was an incredibly welcome boost to Insignia and traffic and registrations and everything there. And guess what? Halo 2 is working online through matchmaking, and it's really awesome to see. This was a huge step in the right direction, not only in terms of reverse engineering, because Halo 2 not only uses so many services for the original Xbox, but on top of that, much like the original Xbox Live, a lot of people were holding off to get Insignia until Halo 2 was supported. And at this point, I am happy to say that those people do not have an excuse. So if you were waiting for Halo 2 to be supported on Insignia, well, it's supported on Insignia. Get online. One of our favorite chips, the RP2040, ends up making another appearance, this time around on the original Xbox. Here with Malenko sharing this video stating Xbox scene member Shaux has been working on a RPI-based mod chip. Here's a video they posted running Surbios on a Pico. Follow along in the Xbox Scene Discord in open source projects. And this is a quick 7-second video here where he has an original Xbox. It is hooked up to power. It looks like there is a Raspberry Pi Pico that is hooked up here and wired up. And when he turns on the system, check it out. Surbios instantly comes up, showing that there is a custom BIOS which is running on this original Xbox thanks to this chip right here. Now, this did get a release here in the form of, I believe this is going to be called Modzo or ModXO, which is a Xbox LPC port mod chip using a Raspberry Pi Pico. Modzo is the firmware that makes a Raspberry Pi Pico into an original Xbox mod chip. Now, some planned features are that they plan to implement L-frame cancel to make it compatible without lifting an L-frame pin on the version 1.6, which is shown right here in the diagram, so hopefully you don't have to lift this pin later on. Another thing is going to be to implement device communication, specifically with LCD. So you can essentially make your own really cool LCD setup, kind of like what we had with the Xcuter 3 mod chip, with the Xcuter 3 control panel and the Xcuter 3 LCD. It looks like if we come to the releases page here, there's only one release, and it says BIOS files are independent from the Modzo firmware, and you're going to use this Pi script to flash bin to UF2 to generate the BIOS UF2 file that you then flash over. So essentially, you then have to download your own custom BIOS, such as Surbios. You download that, you have to run this Python script right here that will then convert that bin file into a UF2 file, which you then flash that UF2 file to your Raspberry Pi Pico. And then if you come back over here, you then go through the process of installing it. Now, there's two of them here. There's the Raspberry Pi Pico, and there's the RP2040. It doesn't matter which board you use. These two are just two of the most common ones, but it's really the actual microcontroller itself, which is important, which is this chip right here. So you could even, as long as you have your own RP2040, you can build your own PCB, which I've been seeing people doing. However, it seems to be that this is a 7-wire install, and it also requires 4 additional 100 ohm resistors. So as long as you run the script and you're a bit confident with your soldering ability, this doesn't look like a bad install at all. And excuse me, I might have said 7 wires, so this is going to be an 8 wire install, but still, this is really awesome to see. I also love this because while original Xbox mod chips are certainly not hard or impossible to get a hold of, they are niche enough where you are going to have to order or even import them, and then I know the last few years, quality on them has definitely degraded. So either you might be taking a chance on buying a chip somewhere, or you might have to get it from a smaller, like homebrew type shop at times. But I do love that you can take completely off the shelf parts like this. Like you can buy a Pi Pico in a store, or you can get a RP2040 in a store, or just buy one online. Wires, going to be easy enough to get. And then resistors, same thing with that. So really, as long as you have the software, which is the Modzo right here, you can quite literally build your own original Xbox mod chip, which dare I say, if this works as well as it should here, this is probably going to be better, and it can even be cheaper than getting a specific proprietary original Xbox mod chip. So I love seeing that here. Now, branching off of this here a little bit, this does have the original Xbox in the name of it, and it's even RP2040 based. However, this is the OG X Mini, which is another release I had seen here from Wired Opposite, which is a RP2040 USB gamepad emulation for multiple platforms. So this is one of the boards that is being shown right here. But it says here, firmware for the RP2040 setup for the Adafruit Feather USB host board, which can be used with the Pi Pico as well. It's capable of emulating gamepads for the original Xbox, of course, but you can also emulate gamepads for the PS3, the Nintendo Switch as long as it's docked, X input, not Xbox 360, and the PlayStation Classic. It also seems to support these controllers, so the wired controllers, it supports both for the original Xbox, all for really the Xbox 360, One, Series, and Elite, DualShock 4, DualSense, it says DualSense Edge should work but it's untested, the Switch Pro controller, the Nintendo Switch wired, so tested with a Power A controller, the N64 USB controller, it's experimental, tested with a Retrolink brand, and PlayStation Classic ones. And then for wireless adapters, you can use the Xbox 360 PC adapter, the 8-bit DOE version 1 or 2 Bluetooth adapters as long as they're set to X input mode, and most wireless adapters that present themselves as Switch, X input, or PlayStation controllers should work. And if you want to use the Pico itself, you really just have something like this where essentially you have your breakout board, you have the Pico here, you get this all wired up to a USB port like this, and then from here, you're connecting this out to your console. So this is really awesome to see here, and again, just more stuff that we get to see on the original Xbox, but even branched out further. And of course, we see our familiar friend here, the RP2040 microcontroller. Now, switching to the Vita a little bit, this is an older port here, and it's currently still in development, I would say, because the first release is 0.5. However, this here is Night in the Woods, one of my favorite games of all time, which I was shocked to see got a Vita port, but it hasn't gotten too much attention. This is from developer PatnosDD, and they say this repo contains patches that you can use in order to get fully working files for my port. You do need to buy the game on GOG, the version 4.06, to make it work. And they also say that overclock is necessary, only the Windows version is supported when you bring your data files over. So there are some issues of low quality or non-working audio in some scenarios, textures not being displayed properly, misaligned cutout, and improper controller button icons in some places. And it looks like this is similar to many of the other ports where you have to download the VPK file and install it on your Vita. Then you need to bring over your game files, but there's also going to be a specific patch you need to apply. And once you transfer over those patches, files, you should be good to continue on with this game. I did originally see this on the Vita DB Twitter, but there are a few screenshots of it right here. And again, I absolutely love this game. I love how charming it is, and I can't recommend this game enough. So I have it on other platforms, but it looks like I'm gonna have to get it on PC, specifically on GOG, because I really want to try this out on Vita. And something that kind of popped out here, I thought this was cool though, and definitely worth covering. This was from Ribshark, which is introducing the first beta release of Safe Disk Shim, a tool that allows safe disk protected games of all versions to run on modern versions of Windows without the driver. See the repository and download the release over here. So we can go ahead, click on this page here for the release. And giving this a read here, they say that Safe Disk Shim is purely designed as a compatibility tool. No security mechanisms are bypassed in the operation of this tool, and safe disk protected games still require their original disks in order to function, even when using this tool. Certain games may have additional compatibility issues outside of the safe disk protection. This tool makes no attempt to fix such issues. Due to the techniques used, certain anti-malware programs may wrongly detect this software as being malicious. And for the introduction here, for anyone who might not know, they do say that this is a compatibility tool that allows for safe disk protected games which utilize the insecure Macrovision security driver, this secdrv.sys, to run on modern versions of Windows, which have said driver blacklisted. Previous methods to restore functionality to these games relied on forcefully installing the driver, potentially opening security risks. In contrast, this tool does not rely on any drivers to function. Instead, it automatically loads alongside safe disk protected games and intercepts any communication requests that would have been sent to the driver, instead sending the expected response itself and allowing the game to boot. And that's awesome to see. So there's a ton of older safe disk games out there that not only work on new modern Windows, but on top of that, even if you say, oh, I got them working before, you no longer have to deal with a crack, it seems, and you no longer have to deal with forcefully installing a blacklisted driver here. So I love seeing setups like this. Now we have a series of pieces of news here about the PlayStation 3 4.91 update, and let's just go through it in order here. Over on PSX Blaze from STL Cards WS, of course, now he's saying it is safe to update because there's been quite a few updates here. However, the original post, he says, the expected once-a-year firmware update has been executed by Sony, the PS3 4.91 firmware is now live. While an expected update, could this bring other changes to the firmware? Likely not, but it's still early to conclude as this update is fresh as of writing. Do not update. Various exploits, tools, essential homebrew will need to be updated to support the latest firmware update of 4.91. See below for a short FAQ on 4.91, as there is always some confusions around the update process. So this ended up making news because it was just funny for many people really outside of the modding sphere to see the PS3 still being supported and getting a firmware update in 2024, with this system originally releasing in 2006. And I mean, even at this point now, there's been two consoles that have succeeded it. We've seen the PS4 and the PS5 come out. Now, typically, these yearly updates that do come out, it is essentially to update the AACS key, meaning that you can play newer Blu-ray movies and Blu-ray titles on the PS3. So that essentially means here that Sony is still supporting this as a Blu-ray player. And really, from what I see, we're going to continue to get these yearly updates until Sony at some point just decides, hey, we're not going to allow the PS3 to support any new Blu-ray movies. I do know some people have asked about this because Blu-ray players can be updated and can have their keys updated just by being connected to the internet without a firmware update. Unfortunately, from what I understand, that does not work on the PS3. In order for that AACS key to be updated, it has to be updated manually with a firmware update. There's no way to automatically update it. Now, with some of the updates here, the first update to release here was the 4.91 EvoNAT custom firmware. Now, EvoNAT, for those people who do not know, is the developer who the last few years, I mean, they've been developing several tools for the PS3 for a while now and firmwares, but for the last few years, they've really been the main developer behind PS3 custom firmware, to the point where really now when there is a custom firmware, the only one that is available is EvoNAT. But it's quite a good custom firmware. It has Cobra built in. It has a lot of developments on it. So for example, over the last few years, we've covered like the PEX releases, which is a similar to kind of the D-Rex variants of Rebug we saw. So you're essentially able to install a custom firmware on a retail system and then convert it to a development type system. It's not going to be a full debug development system, but you're able to use those development tools on a retail system and get those functionalities, which is really great. And since he's pretty active in the community, he's not only had people help out with the firmware and really give their opinions and such on what things can be changed and added in here. However, there's a ton of features that he ends up packing in here. Now, unfortunately, I don't seem to have a list of like just the net new features that were made from 4.90 to 4.91. However, I do know here we end up getting this, which was we now have the decrypt 3-key and redump ISOs option on here, which was definitely looked at favorably when it was in development for 4.90. And this is what I had talked about before, in which it's able to decrypt a encrypted ISO that you end up putting on a USB drive or a hard drive directly on the system, as long as you have an accompanying disk key with it. So for anybody who had a custom firmware jailbroken PS3 already, they've been able to update to custom firmware 4.91 EvoNAT and be able to get up and running on the latest firmware again with some additional functionality added in. This also opened up the possibility of having the PS3 toolset be updated because it does require a no FSM patch in order to patch your system flash to enable writing of custom firmware. However, typically that patch is not available until there is a single custom firmware out in the wild, so thankfully EvoNAT's release was able to get that kicked off. We later on ended up having an official PS3 HIN 3.3.0 update as well as HFW for firmware 4.91. So this was released about a week and a half later, and I was one of the people who was thankful enough to actually test this here for the team. So I tested on one of my own systems, it was working fine. I gave my feedback back to the team here. We end up getting, of course, that HFW 4.91, which is just the official firmware that has had the WebKit swapped out from 4.82, so it has an exploitable WebKit, but there are a few changes here, one of them being added support for 4.91 CEX firmware. They end up fixing an early reboot problem if you wanted to update with the HIN update package for emergency USB recovery. There was an issue with the PSP launcher and PSP games not working on the previous version of HIN, so that ended up being updated. And as for some resource changes, there was a toggle 99% package install delete function added in the maintenance HFW tools. The download list XML was updated to use updated paths on dev HDD0. They added support for the PS Home catalog path in download list XML, and I thought this was a neat little thing they put in. They added support for dev USB 2 through 7 in the package manager. So now if you are installing packages from the package manager, let's say you have a CECHA model and you have something like, I don't know, a Memory Stick Pro Duo or a SD card or a compact flash card, and you want to be a little fancy and use that, you can now put packages on that, and as long as it's formatted properly, you can install them directly from the package manager. You're now no longer limited to the USB drive and only two of the USB ports for those downloads. So I did want to shout that out here specifically because I do know one of the nice benefits of PS3 HIN is that for the most part, it really just works on higher firmwares. Like even if you want to, as long as you have an HFW and you can install even an older version of like PS3 HIN 3.2.2, it will work on 4.91. However, this one, 3.3.0, does have some really nice changes that have been baked in, so this is actually a worthwhile PS3 HIN update to update to. And finally, that same weekend, we saw a PS3 HIN and HFW release. We ended up seeing the PS3 toolset updated to version 1.2.007. This here meaning if you had a stock PS3 running the latest official firmware, you can simply go to the PS3 toolset site, run the Flash Memory Manager, and be able to patch your internal system flash to be capable of installing custom firmware and be on a jailbroken system yet again, if you had lost your jailbreak. Now, as for the changelog here, taking a look at this, he said that this is a minor update, this B. Garaville himself, saying 4.91 firmware support was added, custom syscall type detection was fixed, IDPS and PSID is now hidden by default, and he also used the opportunity to apply a few minor fixes as well. A more comprehensive update enabling the file manager is currently being worked on and will be rolled out in due time, no ETA as always. Just for info, a few changes were also made to the server. I hope it won't cause any issues. We haven't experienced any during testing. I assume I'll get reports if there are new, unexpected access problems. Now for some sad news here, I almost ended up doing a mod chat over this, but I kind of wanted to let the dust settle, and it ended up settling incredibly quickly. You see, there was big news that came out that Nintendo ended up opening up a lawsuit and suing Tropic Haze LLC, which was the LLC behind the Yuzu and Citra emulators, which are Switch and 3DS emulators respectively. Now, I did want to read this out here because essentially everything in regards to Yuzu and Citra has been shut down. However, here we do have this from Yuzu, so I'll read it as is, but I will say this was also no doubt done with Nintendo's, well, viewers assistance, I guess you can say here. I'll just read it out and you all will be able to see this here. Hello, users and Citra fans. We write today to inform you that Yuzu and Yuzu support of Citra are being discontinued effective immediately. Yuzu and its team have always been against piracy. We started the projects in good faith, out of passion for Nintendo and its consoles and games, and we're not intending to cause harm. but we now see that because our projects can circumvent Nintendo's technological protection measures and allow users to play games outside of authorized hardware, they have led to extensive piracy. In particular, we have been deeply disappointed when users have used our software to leak game content prior to its release and ruin the experience for legitimate purchasers and fans. We have come to the decision that we cannot continue to allow this to occur. Piracy was never our intention, and we believe that piracy of video games and on video game consoles should end. Effective today, we will be pulling our code repositories offline, discontinuing our Patreon accounts and Discord servers, and soon shutting down our websites. We hope our actions will be a small step toward ending piracy of all creators' works. Thank you for your years of support and for understanding our decision. So now with me interjecting in here, again, like I said, this was no doubt written with Nintendo's help, or at least having Nintendo's approval with the final say on here. And for anybody who was completely out of the loop who is reading this here, this might just read right on the surface with people thinking that Yuzu decided to suddenly completely change their paths and only play games as they were intended on their systems without any modifications, without anything else, without using any emulation. It makes it read like they decided to have some kind of, I guess you can say, moral high ground and kind of an epiphany here, which that was absolutely not the case at all. There was a lawsuit here, but of course, that's conveniently not mentioned in this release. Now, there's been a lot of coverage here because really from the time the lawsuit started to when it was settled, it was 1 week. Everyone, including myself, was shocked that it was that quick there. But what ended up happening was essentially there was a permanent injunction in which Tropic Haze had to really shut down all of their efforts, shut down all of their work, could not work on anything Nintendo related, had to give up any type of hardware and software they were working on to Nintendo, and there was also a $2.4 million judgment. Now, I will say right off the bat, I'm not a lawyer, but to my understanding, this did not go to court. This was a settlement that was, you know, done outside of court, and then it was signed off by a judge, meaning that if there's any silver lining here, that settlement essentially means that there is no precedent which is being set on this here. This was a settlement, meaning that one party believed that the other party was wronging them, opened up a lawsuit, and the two parties came together to some kind of agreement. There was no type of trial in a courtroom here, and there was not a judge who's really making the final say on this and kind of deliberating and determining it. It was more these two parties came together, had an agreement, agreed to it, and then a judge just did the final sign off on there. However, I did want to highlight this article here from Shadow One, which is talking about the unknowns of emulation and a breakdown of Yuzu versus Nintendo, and really just highlighting some of the points on this here. So they say here that on February 27th of this year here, news broke out about Nintendo filing a lawsuit against the company in charge of Yuzu, Tropic Haze LLC, and the legal documents provided on the initial filing of the court case focused on several points, from which there are three important factors that were touched upon the most in the court document. One, the Yuzu development team utilizing a Patreon for early access builds, which saw an important rise in support during the release of The Legend of Zelda Tears of the Kingdom, amounting to $30,000 per month before the takedown. Two, the Yuzu emulator facilitating piracy, sometimes even allowing street dates to be broken prior to some games' release dates. And three, the Yuzu emulator circumventing copy protection measures put in place for the Nintendo Switch, and using said circumvention to play unauthorized copies of Switch games in unauthorized hardware. Now, the first thing here is talking about the team utilizing a Patreon, and this was really the thing a lot of people pointed to, essentially saying that the team was getting paid for this here, and even people saying they were selling the emulator, while as that is not necessarily true. And it's even stated here that nothing from the Yuzu emulator was locked behind a paywall, as the emulator was open source and the latest commits of it, from which the early access builds are made from, could easily be compiled and run without the need of a Patreon account or donation. Additionally, the idea of an emulator being sold is not new, as was the case back when Sony filed a lawsuit against Bleem, which was a commercially sold emulator, and the ruling was in favor of Bleem, even though it took Bleem out of business and court fees. Despite this, and for the sake of being safe when handling emulation software of any kind, it's better to rely on a fully open source environment without any form of financial incentive. And that is even where I'll interject right here, because it didn't touch specifically on Tears of the Kingdom, at least with this explanation. But I will say that was also something that a lot of people pointed to. One, this was a current generation system, so it did get a lot of attention. And two, Tears of the Kingdom, that leak ended up happening. It was a little bit of an early leak. I think the game leaked out about a week and a half before release date, and it was pirated a ton. I believe, according to the lawsuit, it was alleged that it was pirated about a million times before it was sold. And I have no doubt that many people who pirated the game ended up running it on an emulator here. So I will say, in my opinion here, with some people might be asking why Nintendo did this now and against this here, I'll say that the Switch is pretty close to end of life. It was a huge game for the Switch. I don't see a bigger game releasing for the Switch ever after Tears of the Kingdom. So it was their bigger game. It was a huge leak. The Yuzu emulator is incredibly mature, and the leak was really big. Like I said, a million downloads before the game was officially released. So really, you're dealing with a huge system, a huge game, a huge leak, and here you can just point at the emulator and say, this is clearly the hugest emulator here, because you can look at this Patreon page screenshot here, and it says they were making about $30,000 a month by the end. Number two is Yuzu allowed users to play games with broken street dates before an official date. So really meaning here, you could play games before they were released. And this is nothing new. Like, since the beginning of time, games have been getting leaked out like this. If anything, games used to get leaked out sometimes even earlier, sometimes a month or two in advance, not just a week or 5 days or a week and a half prior. Now, this one, the parts I kind of want to pick out here and highlight, they state here that a video game emulator, Yuzu in this instance, is specifically designed to simulate or imitate actual hardware, Switch. If the programming of the emulator is accurate enough to achieve an imitation of the hardware at a decent level, it will of course run games designed for the actual hardware with little to no tweaks, as seen with homebrew games released past the console's lifespan. During the Tears of the Kingdom leak, which is cited as a prime example in the legal document, Yuzu didn't work at all with the game, giving a black screen. Other Switch emulators did boot the game, but with a lot of bugs and glitches. During the whole time frame before the official release of the game, none of the emulators committed any code addressing issues with leaked games. It wasn't until the game was officially released that code started to be worked on for the game in hand. For Tears of the Kingdom specifically, the manner in which users managed to run the game through Yuzu was through unofficial forks and builds being made from the GitHub repository, with these builds being shared through different outlets online and a lot of people working to provide patches and modifications that made the game run. As an additional note regarding this time frame, the Yuzu emulator team frequently refused pull requests and issue reports on their GitHub based on Tears of the Kingdom during the time frame between the start of the leak and the official release date, and only started work on it once they got a legitimate copy of the game on release. So that's a really interesting point here that I haven't seen too many people touch up on, if any at all, where, like I said, I mean, they were aware this emulator was being used for pirated copies of the game because people were trying to do work on it, but there was not any work, at least officially here, we see being touched on with this. Now, this has also been covered. I've seen online people discuss this, and I'm glad this was brought up, but they said to close up this point, it's entirely plausible that one of the main reasons why the Yuzu team was sued over piracy claims is that they very well could have been sharing ROM files between themselves for the development of the emulator, or just engaging in piracy themselves and being caught on. This is certainly a possibility, and some of the images from the lawsuit documents seem to hint at this as well. Getting legitimate copies of the games that are being worked on for compatibility with the emulator would have been the best course of action for this, or at least not brag openly about it. Now, the big one here being that Yuzu circumvents Nintendo DMCA copy protection measures. And we've seen this here with Nintendo using the DMCA to take down Lockpick RCM, for example, citing anti-circumvision protections and such. However, if you also ever look at Nintendo's terms of service and kind of their anti-piracy measures, essentially, they firmly believe that even though, you know, for example, we've seen with Bleem, under certain circumstances, like as long as you're not redistributing proprietary code and what have you, that is going to be fine. However, according to Nintendo, their own personal belief is emulation illegal. The end. That's it. And mainly here, some of what was pointed to was here saying no person shall circumvent a technological measure that effectively controls access to a work protected under this title, and also information in regards to reverse engineering and not reverse engineering. Now, it even states here, this all makes it seem as if indeed circumventing Nintendo's copy protection measures are in violation of the DMCA. However, there's still personal use and fair use, which according to, they say here, the University of Melbourne sums up the following. Now, keep in mind, this is from an Australian university, but they do talk about personal use limitations, saying ownership of a physical or digital copy of the material being reproduced. Please note that this does not include stream material where a license fee is paid for accessing material. Streaming services do not give users ownership of material on their sites. Material on these sites is leased or rented. Private use includes the full copying of works, and lending or sharing of copies is not allowable. And for a more US-based university, the University of Salisbury, which is based out of Maryland, ends up having an entry regarding fair use and personal use. But they do state here that personal use allows for format shifting, which means that a copyrighted material, such as a video recording being transferred into a DVD, and other examples in the same vein, enter into personal use as well. Now, they did talk about the guides here, saying that the guides that Yuzu provided to dumping your own keys out of the switch, that could very well enter into the DMCA section for copy protection circumvention, making it another possible key factor into the lawsuit. For this case, it'd be better off just mentioning that the user requires their own legitimately dumped keys without providing any actual steps on how to do it, like other emulators do for BIOS files and other required files, where they simply mention the file needed but not how to get it. With all that said, it is still unknown exactly if a copy protection circumvention would fall under a DMCA exception for fair use personal use, since most of the copyrighted material nowadays comes with some form of copy protection, be it from music, movies, games, computer programs, etc. This point still remains to be properly tested in a modern legal court case, as it would certainly pave the way for what actions companies might take against emulators for video game consoles that use encryption of any kind. And that's the big point about it too, where I've also seen a lot of people believe that emulation is fine. However, emulation that is related to any type of encryption, people believe could be illegal. So that's all to say, that is why it's important that there was a settlement, but that settlement doesn't necessarily mean precedent, because this still, at this point, even with this lawsuit settled, there has not been a precedent set. However, looking at this here, I think the biggest reason or reasons as to why this ended up happening were, well, in regards to everything being so big. This is the biggest system that Nintendo has had in a long time, one of the biggest systems ever. This is the biggest game that was going to be released on the system. This is going to be the last big game on the system. This was a big leak that happened, and they were pointing at the biggest emulator right here. So this was definitely more to send a message. And I will say, there's been kind of a cascading effect from it, and a lot of people who seem to have received that message, at least for the time being. I think there's going to be a lot of people who will be kind of shutting their doors, so to speak, for the time being, and then once the emulation scene cools down, we'll see what happens. But I mean, if you've been even looking at the side here, I don't even have to jump into these topics here, but for example, right after this lawsuit was filed, Amazon removed Emulation Station from its App Store because it facilitates piracy. Nintendo sent another DMCA notice for the SysPatch Updater homebrew. The Drastic DS emulator on Android is now free to download, but it's going to be taken down soon, and that was taken down by the actual developer themselves. The 3DS homebrew tool FBI Title Manager removed from GitHub. Again, this was removed by the developer themselves. The Citra 3DS emulator was taken down, but that was because that was from the same team that worked on Yuzu, and part of their permanent injunction was that they had to stop anything Nintendo related, which also included Citra. I will say, with these other takedowns, I feel like the Nintendo DMCAs, Nintendo kind of feels like they're on a roll, and with the self takedowns, for example, Drastic and FBI, I feel like those ones are going to be more knee-jerk reactions. However, one thing about emulation is that it never really stops. You see, there can be emulators that are stopped, there can also be emulators that are taken down, but when there's takedowns, there's always mirrors that come back up, and especially if you're dealing with open source emulation, such as Yuzu, well, you end up getting forks such as, well, it looks like the most promising one after about 100 different ones were made seems to be, funny enough, is called Suyu, which on Ars Technica, they end up covering it here, believing this is how the makers of Suyu will plan to avoid getting sued. Now, it seems like there is development on it, but it seems to be funny at the same time, because, for example, one of the contributors, a moderator named Sharpie, end up saying Suyu currently exists in a legal gray area we are trying to work our way out of. But they also did say that they consulted with an unnamed someone with legal experience, with Sharpie saying that they claimed 3 years of law school. The Suyu development team has decided to avoid any monetization. So that's one of them here, with people pointing at the Patreon. It seems like the project's GitLab here is stating, we do not intend to make money or profit from this project. It looks like they've also been warned against providing step-by-step guides like the ones Yuzu offered for how to play copyrighted games in the emulator. So they're just essentially saying, hey, here's the code, bring your own games, bring your own keys, we're not going to help you out there. They're also doubling and tripling down in regards to not supporting piracy, which, to be fair, Yuzu and Citra also had stated this as well too, so this is nothing new, but they do state, we do not support or condone piracy in any form. And the number one rule on their Discord is that piracy is prohibited. And that includes any talk about downloading games or asking for system files, ROMs, encryption keys, shader caches, and discussion of leaked games. Now, you will also still have to bring your own keys, which you'll have to get from modifying and dumping them from your own Switch, which, again, they're not going to be helping on here, it seems, but you will still need those for the emulator to function. And so far, at least at this point in time here, they are not distributing binaries for download, at least yet. But the source code is available. You can download it, you can read it, you can check it out, and you can compile it as well too if you want to compile your own build of Suyu to work. So I will say I was a little bit surprised that this was the option that ended up moving forward here, because like I said, whenever there's any kind of takedown like this, typically you'll see 20, 50, 100, 200 mirrors pop up, which is exactly what happened with Yuzu. But it seems like Suyu seems to be the most prominent one. Now that we talked about a whole lot of negative emulator news, let's talk about something positive here, which this was covered and this ended up getting quite a bit of positive attention. This is from Sky Flugel or Flugel. They said here that they just released Red Viper, a Virtual Boy emulator that runs on the Nintendo 3DS. All official games run at full speed. And this is it right here. Now, this is actually, I just noticed, running on an old 3DS, which is even more impressive. And the sad thing is here is that this seems to be functioning and working so well. And when I say sad, I don't mean it as in, oh, this is a really sad attempt. No. I see, oh, you could even change the colors there too. That's awesome. I say this is sad because I'm looking at this like, this is such a missed opportunity for the 3DS. This could have been an officially released thing for the 3DS, and it shocks me that I don't think there was not a single Virtual Boy like VC Inject or anything that was released for the 3DS, not to my remembrance at least. But they state here that 3D is supported, you can change the color, the right D-pad can be controlled via the touchscreen or via the face buttons, with the Virtual Boy's face buttons being on the touchscreen. The new 3DS C-Stick is mapped to the right D-pad. Circle Pad Pro should be possible, but haven't looked into it. Thank you so much, everyone. The reception has been amazing. I have some really cool stories about the tech that went into this. Not sure where best to put them, but I'll definitely tweet about it. And if we check out the GitHub page here for Red Viper, we can come over here. You can always go to releases, and you can download the latest release here. And there's been a couple of them. So this is the initial one, and then there was an update here, which this seems to be the most stable one, of course, but they say, this release fixes the random crashes in T&E Soft's games, so Red Alarm, 3DS, 3D Tetris, Golf. Now all official games are actually playable. On top of that, they also end up fixing a crash when closing through the home menu while in the pause menu. So this has gotten some nice support, but it seems like this really just came out of nowhere and it has gotten, it's been working incredibly well. So this is really awesome to see. Now, typically at the end of these episodes here, I like to cover something that is funny, cool, interesting, what have you, kind of tangentially related to the world of video game modding. And one of the things here is going to be from Insomniac Games with the recent release of Spider-Man 2. They end up putting up this warning tweet saying, we're aware the latest game update may have inadvertently allowed access to a development game menu. There's a hotfix on the way. Please note that using this menu could corrupt your saves and trophy progress. There is no risk associated with playing the game as intended. Which seems to be kind of a very like boilerplate type response here or tweet. But then you just look at it here, and this is quite literally what happened. This user ended up posting this up and said, how do you mess up this badly? And looking at these screenshots here, for those who did not know, in the 1.02 update that was released, there was a full debug menu. That was it. That's all there was. And I believe to access it, you just had to touch options and touchpad. You just had to hold them down at the same time and it would come up. So here you could see for the Beetle villain arc, you could jump to any point in it. Next up here, you had the actual menu here. So some of the options for like debug draw are like display system info, filter titles, Force long play reloads. You can turn that on or off. Enable delayed streaming. Override lighting mode. Lighting zones enabled. Texture streaming. Display loose load detail. So there's a lot of just nitty-gritty developer options that you can change here. Oh, and this is nice. Actually, at the bottom, they even cite what this is. So for example, with force long play reloads, it says down here, if true, the actual time between reloads is ignored and every long play reload script node will force a quick reload. Next up here, the dev menu itself. You can go through different kinds of playthroughs. So the connected playthrough, the 2023 press preview, the user experience playthrough, Gutiful Corner, missions and activities, tracking demo, debug front end. And finally here, it looks like some more information, which you can see like all the info here. So the version package i30 gold. This is the build date here, tile update 1 it seems, PS5 submission, build machine that it was on, the code specifically here, which this is the gold master you can say, and the info here saying 4K display, HDR enabled. Also nice here, you could actually see the specific build time, so this was built on Valentine's Day at 10:09 a.m., and I believe that would be Pacific Standard Time. Some extra tweets here, he says, by messing with the debug menu, you can even get the new trophy, so you have finished the main story in New Game Plus, great job hero, you end up getting that. It looks like there is some footage of God Mode being enabled right here, and again, this is... I love this. This is great. There's no cheat codes here. There's no save hacking. There's no save transferring. There's no mods. There's no jailbreaking. Nothing. Quite literally, you have a PlayStation 5. You put in Spider-Man 2. You download the 1.02 update and you stay on there. And this is it. It looks like they also posted here Venom and Free Roam. So indeed, that is Venom and Free Roam. Although these are boring, you can also free roam as Mary Jane and Young Peter with the reload menu attached. And for the last tweets here, they said Insomniac is forcing version 1.002.001, so barely an incremental one there, to all players before playing. It's patched. Wish more developers these days realize players can actually have fun messing around with dev menus if they know what they're doing. For those who have version 1.002.000, you can bypass the update by turning off your router before turning on the PS5, turn on the PS5, and turn off the Wi-Fi settings. Then you'll be able to use the debug and dev menu in-game offline. That's a little bit more of a complex version on here. I believe you could also just disable like automatic updates on there, but this is still really cool to see. And I would say to this point here, because there are probably many people who are wondering why developers don't leave this in. According to Sony certification and all that, I really don't think they're able to leave this in here. And even if they leave it in, because there's many times many retail games actually have developer menus in there, they have to be disabled, on the Gold Master. So they just somehow forgot to disable this one here, but this is still it's still really awesome to see. I love seeing this.
Anyways, that is about it for this episode of Mod Chat. Now, if you've made it here to the end, typically I like to pick a keyword or a key phrase. And if you use this keyword or key phrase in a comment on the YouTube upload, I'll know that you've made it to the end. So typically I end up picking something off of my desk here. And you know what? We're just going to do this. How about phone? Let's just do that. Not going to be the most original thing. But what type of phone do you have? Do you like big phones such as this? Do you miss having a smaller phone? Do you miss having a landline phone? Do you still have a landline phone? Use the word phone in your comment on the video upload here, and I'll know that you've made it to the end. Anyways, that is about it for this episode here of Mod Chat. As I always say, this is Mr. Mario signing off. Thank you all for watching, everyone. If you enjoyed this episode, a like would absolutely be appreciated. And if you didn't like it, well, a dislike is fine as well too. But again, to restate, as I always say, this is Mr. Mario signing off. Thank you all for listening and watching, everyone. And until next time.